Welcome to What We Watch When We Drink, a Booze Dancing Entertainment Network podcast featuring lively discussions about movies, TV shows, and anything else that we're watching while we drink our favorite boozy beverages. If you enjoy this show, please subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, Google, Audible, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. You can also find us on boozedancing.com, and if you have any questions, comments, show, or drink suggestions, email us at boozedancing@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.
The Booze Dancing Entertainment Network is live on a Whiskey Wednesday. We always get together on Wednesdays, it seems like. And this is going to be a real fun one. We have a special guest. We are live on the YouTube, on the Facebook, on the Twitter, X, whatever it's called, LinkedIn. What else? Instagram?
Instagram. You got it. Instagram.
Networking? That's working too. We are very lucky to have a very special guest who comes from a radio background. So our unofficial sponsor tonight is Two for Tuesday and Morning Zoos all over the country. We love the crazy, wacky mornings of Morning Zoos and crazy radio promotions here. And we'd like to have some ourselves one day if we had an actual radio promotion department. But we don't. So we are lucky to welcome in Sue Carpenter, who has a very varied background, I will say. And we're going to get into that, as well as talk about a movie tonight that has a kind of a connection to it all. It's also a radio-related movie. Welcome, Angela. Welcome, Mike. Welcome, Sue.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Hello.
Hello, hello. Sue, where are you tonight?
I'm sitting on my couch in my house in Los Angeles.
Ah, another West Coaster like myself. Well, the boys are on the East Coast. How's it back East, boys?
Hot.
Yes, today was hot. A hot day.
Hot, hot? Like hot, hot?
It's like 85, 86.
Now, it's like 85, 86. It was about 90 today.
Did it hit 90?
What?
I don't know.
Well, we have lovely 70-something degree weather here in the LA area. So,
well, it's gonna go back down. It's going to rain for a couple days. You know, it's going to be joyous.
Joyous. Well, where should we start tonight, guys? We have a lot to cover. We have a lot to cover with our guests. We have a lot to cover with our movie. Should we start with whiskey? Should we start with something we're drinking?
Let's pour ourselves a drink.
All right. So we were talking to Sue beforehand. She didn't realize that we drink during the show. It's what we watch when we drink. That's the name of the show, which I probably forgot to mention. And this is episode 47 for those keeping score at home. So we go around the room and pour something. Talk about what we're pouring, maybe why we're pouring, and then we'll do a little toast. So our guest should go first, I think. Sue?
Yes.
What do you got?
All right, I pre-poured. So
pre-pouring's fine. We like pre-pouring.
So this lovely drink I chose because it is a lovely
pretty.
Los Angeles. It's Campari. I was going to do this just because it's novel, Manx. Do you know what this
what
is?
What is that?
No, I don't. What
no,
is that?
What is that?
It's like engine cleaner, basically. I went to the island 15 years ago, and our local drink, and I just couldn't make myself pour it. That's why I got the Campari.
What is it again? Yeah, but what is it?
It's called Manx. It's the Isle of Man's regional beverage.
Oh, okay.
Wait, what's the say on the label? What is it? Is it whiskey?
Is it Man or is it Manx?
It is Manx. Okay. And it just simply says spirit.
Interesting.
What's the alcohol percentage on it?
40%
ABV. Okay, so it could be. It's probably whiskey.
Yeah.
It's probably whiskey.
Or is it more like that?
Oh, it's clear.
No, is it like was it Poitine or Poitine or is that what it's called? What do they call that? The Irish.
That's in Ireland.
Right, Ireland. Where's Isle of Man? Is Isle of Man between Scotland and
I'm
Ireland?
I'm looking it up.
Or
yeah,
did you go for the races?
I did. Yeah.
Average little bio. You like your motorcycles, so I assume you went for the Isle of Man TT?
I did.
Mm-hmm. Did you race in the Isle of Man TT?
No, I rode the course.
Okay.
And,
they're insane.
I should say.
That's a crazy drive. That's a crazy race.
Well, it's a crazy race. It's a gorgeous ride if you don't try to race it, you know?
Okay.
Well, I just looked this stuff up.
So it where's is... the Isle of Man?
Not that. I didn't look at that. I looked up what Manx is.
Oh, okay.
And it is a clear crystal spirit that is redistilled from pure malt whiskey. whatever the heck that means. Okay, right.
So I should have poured that.
Which has been matured in oak cask by our Celtic neighbors, is then purified in our specialized stills before bottling.
See, wow. So it's practically poison.
That's kind of cool.
Or poison or whatever it's called.
Yeah, well, it's 40%, so it's not high ABV, but that's whiskey. Okay, that would so make a good cocktail.
So the Isle of Man is in between, I guess. What would that be, that body of water between the Great Britain and Ireland?
I think it's the Irish Sea.
Irish Sea, yeah.
I think so.
In the middle. And it looks like it's pretty much, almost straight across from Belfast. So.
Sounds right. Well, that's a, you got to pour that one later.
All right.
But Campari's fine enough. Campari's good too.
Fun.
Ange,
fun.
Ange, what you got?
All right. Well, since we're talking radio and, you know, classic rock, I've got Rod Stewart. Well, not classic rock, but, you know, rock stations and all that good stuff. I've got Rod Stewart's whiskey, Wolfie's, which is made at the Loch Lomond Distillery.
So that's Scotch. Very nice.
Correct.
Wow. Is that, blended did Scotch that come whiskey. Up this year? When did that come up?
This year or last year? I'm not really sure. We reviewed it recently, though. So.
What you got, Mikey?
Can't hear you.
You're muted, Mikey. You're muted. You're muted. This is radio.
I got the Brothers Bond Straight Bourbon.
Oh, okay. How is that?
It's pretty good. 40%. Yeah.
All right. The usual. I have a Amrit from our friend Raj. This is Indian whiskey. This is a K&L, K&L Wines. You know, Sue, do you know K&L Wines in Hollywood? It's a wine shop. There's a very cool wine shop. This bottling was just for them, and it's a 6-year-old private barrel. So,
ABV.
All right, now we do our little clink clink. So now we try to go clink. Ready? 1, 2, 3.
Cheers.
Well done.
There we go. Let's learn about Sue.
All right, Sue. This is it. You get grilled. All right. So I should give a little bit of bio for Sue. She is a digital journalist. Can you stop me if I get any of this wrong? You've written for that's true. Nowhere near this is a real journalist. She has a typewriter. Okay. We don't have that, right? She's written for The Times, New York, and LA, NPR, various magazines, Marketplace, Los Angeles, Jane, Marie Claire, Cosmo. She used to work at KPCC, public radio here in LA. And she's written everything from motorcycles to climate change to culture to politics. She has covered the map in journalism. And you still work at Spectrum, correct?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Correct. And Spectrum, those don't have Spectrum television, we do here. It is Channel 1, I believe. And it's an ongoing 24-hour news station, pretty much, right?
Yes. Is that owned by Spectrum Cable?
It is.
Correct.
Indeed.
Yeah,
it is. Your nemesis, Aaron?
Because it's my nemesis, because their TV quality just drives me crazy watching Dodger games and Laker games. But that's another story. But this varied background goes back a little bit to when Sue was living in the Bay Area. And she has this fascinating story, which we want to talk about tonight. For some crazy reason, this woman wanted to start a radio station in her apartment. Sue, I'll let you pick it up from there.
Okay, so... Yeah, when I lived in the Bay Area, it was in the early 90s, and I don't know if any of you ever lived up there, visited there at that time.
Been visited. Oh, I know it well.
So I think this was San Francisco's glory days. It was sort of, technology was happening, but nobody really paid any attention. So in the city itself of San Francisco, it was sort of very hippie punk, very creative, very musical, but the radio was horrible. And so I... used to listen to the radio a lot, and then I got involved in college radio, and then I decided that I wanted to start my own commercial radio station, not knowing that to do that was going to cost me $20 million that I did not have. That brought me through a process that I will not bore you with here to the doorstep of a hippie radical by the name of Stephen Dunifer, who lived over in Berkeley, and he was fighting the man, so to speak. He was illegally broadcasting with a handmade, home-built transmitter that he designed. And he would hike up into the Berkeley Hills and he would broadcast from there on Sunday nights. And he had kind of an environmental political agenda. And the FCC came after him, and then he defended himself and just said, you know, why can't I be on the air? You know, so he created this legal limbo, and also was building all these transmitter kits, which I bought one of once I knew that he existed. Bought a transmitter kit, built a transmitter, and my idea was that I was just going to broadcast all the music that people weren't able to hear in San Francisco. So that was in 1995. And I did that for a few months and then got a job. As you mentioned, I'm a journalist, got a job down in Los Angeles and had just gotten my appetite wet with, you know, running a radio station. So I brought it with me and brought it down to Los Angeles. And that's when it just sort of blew up into this huge thing. I say it blew up into this huge thing. You guys have probably never even heard of this, but, you know, it became a thing. In the community.
I think Aaron can't hear you. Uh-oh.
Was the goal to hear music that you couldn't hear on the radio, or was the goal to have a radio station? Or was it both?
The goal was really to hear music that I wanted to hear that I couldn't find, because the radio station up there at the time was Live 105, the college radio stations. The one that was good, that was broadcast out of San Francisco, University of San Francisco, the music programming stopped at 6 at night. So it was really just to play all the stuff that you couldn't hear on commercial radio and that wasn't available anywhere else. And then I think eventually it turned into, there's so many things do. You start for one reason, it sort of morphs into something else. So it was always about being able to play a variety of music. But at some point it became about the ownership of the station and who gets access to the airwaves.
Had you thought about going to work for a small radio station, a college station, or going in the front door instead of the back door?
I did. I volunteered at the radio station out of UC Berkeley, Calex. So I was a DJ there. I also ran the women's department. And that actually was pivotal for my journalism career also. I don't know how your lives have evolved. But typically what I do is when I have an interest in something, I just throw spaghetti at the wall and see what happens. And so I was interested in journalism. I was interested in radio. And I just started pursuing both at the same time. And they both sort of delivered for me at the same time. Yes, to answer your question, I did try to go through the front door. But I never, you know, there wasn't really an opportunity to make money in college radio to elevate through the ranks of management, nor did I think I really wanted to do that. Didn't try to get in the door of commercial radio because I didn't like those stations. But
so when you came to LA, did you ever think about going into regular commercial radio ever?
No, because I always thought of myself as a writer. And this is where the journalism piece comes in, you know? So yeah. I was pursuing a written journalism career at that time. And just was making this music available through this little radio startup over on the side.
I should add, so Sue wrote a book about this experience called 40 Watts from Nowhere. Is that pretty there? And which is really great. I highly recommend it. It's still available on Amazon, I believe. And she details in the book her travels from the Bay Area to Los Angeles and then ultimately setting up a station in her apartment in Silver Lake, which is north of Hollywood here for those who are not from the area. When did the worry start about breaking the law?
I think the worry was always there.
But is that what made it fun?
You know, I think that really kind of helped make a community out of it, because it wasn't just that you went in and you did your thing. It was like everybody sort of felt protective toward it. Like they wanted it to succeed. And there's something about being the underdog, you know, that makes people bond and made it more special. Definitely. Yeah.
You said community. So when you're in the Bay Area and you're starting this thing and you're in your apartment, you probably have no idea if anyone's listening. You could be talking to yourself in your room, right? So this community is one at the moment in the beginning, right?
Well, I set a schedule. So it was 4 hours every night, and it was only me 2 hours once a week. And then the rest was filled out with my friends. So everybody, the DJs, and this is something that existed, except that I didn't know anybody when I came to LA, where every 2 hours it was a different DJ playing whatever it is that they wanted. And then the community, you know, this imaginary community at first was because I had set up a voicemail box, you know? So I didn't want a phone line directly to my house because I thought that would be traceable.
Right.
I'm sure that the voicemail system was also quite traceable.
No, not at all.
It probably was, yes.
But I have all these cardboard protections that I set up for myself, and that was one of them. So there was a voicemail, and so people could call in, and there were people listening. I have no idea how many, you know?
You must have been shocked when you were getting those first voicemails and phone calls that there's, oh my God, people can hear me. People can hear us.
Hear me. It works, you know? Like
it works.
I mean, I'm not somebody who's technically like good, you know, I don't understand. I never really understood how radio even worked. And then suddenly I was handed this like manila envelope with parts and like, like this is how you do it. And so that's how
what's the range? Like how far will the radio wave travel?
It really depends. Depends on how high you are. So my transmitters were between like 20 and 40 watts.
Elevation, right? We're talking elevation.
Yes.
It is California. Just making sure.
Yes, it is about elevation.
That doesn't happen here. Not at all.
No. It was probably a couple miles, you know. It was very limited. It was very like to the neighborhood, you know.
Okay.
And it also depends on the weather and lots of things going on, other noise going on in the airwaves.
Yep. So it was primarily music, right?
Yep.
So did people just, I mean, did your co-conspirators just bring in their own albums and just play them?
For the most part. Yeah. Okay. I mean, I had a lot of labels that were giving me music for free. And
I found really fascinating that
that's kind of cool.
The word got out to the music community, to the professional music community, not just people listening, you know, fans, listeners. It got out to the broader music community. So bands were coming to you, labels are coming to you, this little entity. That's amazing.
Was it like a dead drop? Like you couldn't give me your address, right?
Another one of my cardboard.
I'm just saying.
Pull up a P.O. box.
There you go.
Traceable to me.
It was like the Americans. They met in the park on a bench.
Right, exactly. Yeah. You know, in a paper bag. The records will be delivered in a paper bag.
There's missing one big factoid of this whole story of Sue's. She didn't use her real name. She had a separate name just for the radio station, which was
Paige Jarrett.
She was Paige Jarrett.
Paige Jarrett.
She was.
How did you come with that?
Well, you know, I've always had the most boring name. Like, I guess it's good considering what it is that I do for a living. Sue Carpenter is a very easy name, right? But I always thought it was just so boring. So not that Paige Jarrett is like, it's like it's exotic in a very waspy way. I loved her name and I just lifted it, you know?
The station call letters in San Francisco were PBJ. PBJ.
Ah, okay. Yeah. So it is a sandwich.
And then here,
KBLT. Yeah, right. All right. I was wondering.
Boom.
About that.
Okay. Boom.
I like it.
That's right.
That's funny.
So then you've got all kinds of folks sending you music, sending you, let's see, LPs in that time, and probably maybe some CDs, or the beginning of CDs or cassettes. Right? There's the record, the labels are sending you stuff.
CDs and 7 inches for the most part. Cassettes were pretty over.
Over by then? Yeah.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden now you've got bands you're kind of helping to promote. You've got this whole different kind of level of, I don't know, almost responsibility to this new community, right?
Yes.
For better or worse.
Yeah, it pretty much like consumed my entire life. Like this little thing that I started just to play music, just especially since more and more DJs wanted to get involved. And then, it was, you know, cataloging all of the music that was coming in, you know, different DJs, new bands, or had supplied music, and the labels that were giving me music were like, hey, this band would like to come in and talk on your show, or talk on your station. So at first it was super local bands, but then it sort of became super huge bands. So everything from, you know, a band like Lutefisk, who was local to Silver Lake, all the way up to, at some point, you know, Thurston Moore from Sonic Youth, and the Reed Brothers from Jesus and Mary Chain, the guy from Spiritualized, Wayne Coyne from the Flaming Lips, and then the Red Hot Chili Peppers is when they played live in my house. Like, that was completely unexpected. I was not there. But so it was, that was the gant, like, that was the trajectory. It was super organic.
That's and awesome.
It was just through who, like, I just let come in, and it was like, who they knew, and these people just knew some insanely famous people, you know?
That part of the story, your house, it threw me just that, you know, you had a regular job, or you had, like, a life, somewhat. And so these people, these DJs would just be coming into your house while you weren't there. I don't know what to say to that.
I know, you know.
This was without a ring. There was no ring camera then. There was no, like, somebody watching over stuff.
I was there a lot of the time. It's funny because my boyfriend now, he's like, sometimes I think that you want to meet everybody in the world. And I think that started at the radio station. It happened super organically. It's sort of like the frog in boiling water, right? Like, I just started it with me and my friends 4 hours a day. And the next thing you knew, I was building out this schedule. It was friends and their friends and their friends, you know what I mean? And then it just became a 24/7 thing in my house. And I had neighbors, you know. One of them was not super, what's strange is that my direct upstairs neighbor from the radio station, I ran into because I went back to the house where I used to run it. He still lives upstairs. And wow. He told me that he never had a problem. Like, he always supported what it was that I was doing, which is shocking because it was loud, you know, and he had hardwood floors. Like, there was no barrier, you know, between what we were doing and where he was living. I mean, it's.
And there's a really big stick sitting out of your house, you know, on the side of the house going 20 feet high. Then that wasn't like a sign or something.
Yeah. When I first put that up there, the neighbor who had lived there before, the other guy who still lives there, I lied and just said that it was a TV antenna.
A really big one.
Like, a super high. And he thought that was hilarious, that I really loved my television. You know, I don't even know. It was my cover, you know?
That's so funny.
You needed the big antenna to pick up the telenovelas that were coming from.
That's right, coming directly from Mexico.
Yeah. And Premier League. Yeah, they get Premier League.
And Premier League. Well, it wasn't a thing back then. Well, it wasn't a big thing then. But getting getting stuff overseas, that's how you get it with a big.
She was ahead of her time. Dish.
She was ahead of her time. She was pre-satellite. Pre-satellite.
Do not discount her ambition.
No. So why don't we take a break here? And if you guys want to refill your glasses, you can. And why don't we talk a little bit about a movie about radio, which I think actually has a really good connection to Sue's story. Sue's got that Campari on ice. I like that. And that's your Campari? Thing.
Just straight Campari?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's good. I like ice.
What's that thing called, Ange?
What? Negroni?
What's the Ferrari? What's that?
Oh, what was the Ferrari?
Campari and it's half and half.
Yeah. What was in that? Was it Scotch? No.
No. It's another Amaro, I think.
Yeah. I'll look it up. I'll find it.
It's just 50-50, I think.
Hmm. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So if you're refilling, go ahead. If you're not refilling, that's okay too. If you want to talk about what you refilled, jump in. I jumped in with a little Israeli whiskey for milk and honey, lightly peated. It's a whiskey from Tel Aviv, single malt whiskey. Boys, can you stand the same right now?
Stay the course.
Oh, by the way, the Ferrari is Fernet and Campari.
Fernet, was it.
And here's a variation: you could do a shakerato. So you take them both.
A what?
You put them both in a shaker with ice, shake the hell out of it, and then it gets like all cloudy because of the sugar and stuff, and it gets kind of frothy. So
that's your your kind of drink. You'd love.
I would absolutely love that. I like the Ferrari. I think that's Isn't
it?
That's right. We did the Ferrari with your wife when we had the California.
That's right. We did the
Jaeger Spirit stuff.
Yeah. Jaeger Spirit. That's right.
Yeah. That was good.
And it's 1-to-1, right?
Yes, 1-to-1.
Yeah, 1-to-1. So those making cocktails at home, Fernet.
So,
one part Fernet, one part Campari. Boom, drink.
Finito.
Ferrari.
Basta.
There you go.
Done.
All right.
Okay. We move. So our movie. Or no?
Yeah, if you'd like, go ahead.
Well, it's okay. Let's go to the movie.
All right.
Stay on track.
So I don't even know what year this came out.
97.
March 7th, 1997. Private Parts. Basically the biography, maybe like an autobiography, of Howard Stern, radio icon. And I see the connection. Well, and you have some factoids about the movie.
Very little. Okay, so Private Parts release date 3/7/1997, budget $28 million, gross box office $41.2 million, opening weekend 14.6. It gets a 6.9 out of 10 on IMDb, a 68% on Rotten Tomatoes, and a 67 Metascore. I'm thinking that, you know, it's going to be like you either love Howard or you don't, and that's why it's lower. Plot summary, like you said, autobiographical story of Howard Stern, the radio rebel, who is now also a TV personality, an author, and a movie star. And it was shot in New York. So Betty Thomas directed, and writers are Howard Stern, Len Blum, and Michael Kalesnikow.
Isn't Ivan Reitman the executive producer?
I believe you are correct.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right? Yep. So these are some heavy hitters behind this movie, right?
Yes.
Totally. Yep. Yep.
He's the king of all media, after all.
He's the king of all media. Correct. So I'm a Stern fan from the way back. I don't know about you guys. Still listen. And I think the rebel part of the story definitely connects to Sue's story as well. But Stern didn't want to go into college radio. He didn't want to go into independent radio. He wanted to go into big time radio. He wanted to be a star, but he wanted to do it his way. I think is really he didn't want to follow the traditional play the top 40 songs and do the morning zoo thing or whatever it was at the time. And I think that's kind of what his background and theory about radio has been. The movie, I think, is a pretty. I've seen it a few times, and I haven't seen it for a long time. It felt a little bit long to me. I don't know about you guys. It was fun seeing all these people,
well,
again after not seeing them for a long time. Like all very, very, very young. But it was fun seeing them all.
I agree with you. Well, yesterday afternoon I got out early from jury duty, so I was like, oh, let me watch it again. So I popped it on before the Phillies game, but. Yeah, the first time around, I thought it was a little slow. But then the second time around, I liked it more. Then I remembered it's just a fun movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I enjoyed it.
I think it. Mike, what did you think?
I was actually surprised when I saw your notes, Ange, that this didn't make more money.
Did or did not?
Did not.
Yeah.
Typically, the rule of thumb, it's a 2-to-1. You know, you got to basically double the production cost.
Well, he did that.
The budget. And he didn't. I thought this movie must have made like $100 million. I was just surprised. Because it was huge, but I guess when you're looking at it with the price of tickets today, price of tickets in 1997, maybe it wasn't a 2-to-1 ratio. Maybe it was a little bit more than covering your cost.
Yeah, yep.
I've never liked Howard Stern because I like music, and he doesn't play any ever.
No music.
So
you like music? Since when?
I do. It might be that all the people I listen to are dead, but I still like music. I'm late to finding all these artists, but when I find them, I like them.
I think Howard's comes from like that old, almost vaudevillian Jewish world of comedy. His dad was a radio producer I think he was a sound technician for like radio comedy and cartoons and things. So like Hanna-Barbera stuff and funny voices and things. But it came out of that sort of old time radio where you're trying to be humorous. Music didn't always fit into that. And that's, I think, Howard wanted to entertain. He didn't want to be a disc jockey per se. And then in the beginning he was, because you most when you start off, you got to do whatever the little radio station owner says you had to do. And that, I think, it shows pretty well in this the movie, that he's working in small towns or Detroit or wherever, and you got to do whatever you got to do for $75 a week until you gain enough stature or power to move on or do what you want.
Until you become radio manager.
Until you become radio manager.
Radio manager. Fire him. Fire him now.
Fire him now. But it's also an interesting look at how, and I think it's probably true of a lot of people in radio, trying to balance a career where you're bouncing around the country, which I'm not sure that's the case anymore with radio, because you can do it from your home, and trying to have a family.
Well, super.
And you can see how he has a difficult time trying to get through his life with his new wife and try to create a family. Very difficult until he gets to the big, and even so, when he gets to the big time, which is another chapter that's kind of crazy. Sue, have you seen the movie? Is that a no? She hadn't seen the movie? Okay.
Sorry.
That's okay. That's fine. Andrew, we were going to talk about the cast for a little bit. I thought the cast was, aside from the people from the show, it's pretty great, right?
It is.
You got Paul Giamatti.
And this is like early Paul Giamatti. I don't think
this is like his first
thing yet.
It's his first big role.
And Allison Janney.
Right. And so, Allison Janney.
What was Paul Giamatti's character?
He
has an engineer vibe.
So he is a
Is he a station manager?
He's a station manager he's basically assigned to keep Howard in line.
Howard gets failed
miserably.
Howard moves from Washington D.C. from a big station in D.C. to NBC WNBC, one of the biggest radio stations in the country.
WNBC,
and so the NBC hires him, not knowing that he is foul mouthed and does what he wants and has no clue, but he's hired anyway. And the upper folks at NBC are like, oh my God, what have we done? We signed this guy to a contract, and now what do we do with him? And Paul Giamatti's character, who's like this, you kind of get the sense he's an old guy that's been in radio for a long time. He says, I will put this guy on a leash. Do not worry. I will either calm him down or he will quit. That's my goal. That's what he's going to quit, or he's going to be great. And he can't control him. And this is based on a real character that was at NBC when Howard was there. And Howard nicknamed him, this person, Pig Virus.
Pig Vomit.
And Giamatti's just this, he's spitting, he's yelling, he's screaming. He can't believe this guy is just like not listening and just going off the rails on radio and all kinds of crazy sexual exploits on radio and crossing all kinds of lines on NBC radio, not just like little podunk radio on, Long Island or something. And he's just out of his mind. And he is so funny and so good at that character. I mean, I don't know if you can see greatness coming from that, from Paul Giamatti then, but now you can, right? Looking at it in today. Oh my God, what an amazing actor.
And one of the things I thought was amazing with the whole thing is that, they're waiting for the quarterly ratings to kick in, and then they're going to fire him because obviously no one wants to hear any of this nonsense.
Right.
And they're all ready to get rid of him, and he wins his time slot. Because this is something everybody wants now. They don't want music. They want this drive time, not shock jock, but just totally different than whatever's on.
Totally different.
And it becomes something where people who like Howard listen for an hour. People who hate Howard listen for 3 hours.
Right. Yes.
And then they sit back and go, well, we can't get rid of this guy. We got to get rid of everybody that wants to get rid of this guy. We'll let him do whatever he wants. We don't care.
And ultimately.
Sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Don Bowles of The Germs, who's a DJ at my station. I interviewed him because I'm making a documentary about the station right now. And one of the things he told me is that, the magic of radio and people like Howard Stern who do so well is like, you can't teach anybody to have a personality. You either have one or you don't. You know what I mean? I am the sort of person who did not have a personality. I was like the worst DJ on my own station. Don Bowles, personality on air. Howard Stern, gifted person on air. You know what I mean? It's just like,
you're right.
Have it, you know?
Yep. Yes, I think you're right. And I think either you're a born entertainer in some way. You can learn a lot of things, but some things you're just born with. And radio DJ or radio personality is one of those things. And you can be born into the being the top 40 guy, like, I don't know, who? Ryan, no, not Ryan Seacrest. What's the other guy?
That would be Ryan Seacrest.
I think he is.
Adam Carolla? Adam?
Oh, Adam Carolla? No, Adam Carolla.
No. What's the other guy? He's like, not Ryan Seacrest, the other one. Whatever.
I don't know, I listen to the radio, so
Wink,
I have no idea.
Wink Martindale. These guys were born from. Who's 90 years old, according to Howard today?
I was like, what a reference. Yeah.
I know. Thank you. Old references are my thing. You can be born into even that kind of style, or you can be born into the style where you are just a perfect music person, or born into a style where you are a personality. It's hard to learn those things. Yeah. And there's those people that have that gift. It really is a gift that they, once they figure out maturity and they figure out what they want to do.
You're saying maturity in the same reference to Howard Stern?
Sure. No. Well, even yes, I think so. I think he figured out in the beginning, you just can't make funny noises all the time. That's not going to sell. That, I mean, maybe in the beginning, early on, to be different, but that's really not what he wanted to do. That's not really what he was aspiring to do. So you kind of fine tune your act or whatever you're trying to do. So yeah, there is like a learning process or maturity, but innately you have that gift. And I think he has that gift, and yeah. Wink Martindale had that gift. And back on KHJ radio. I can't believe he's 90. I was stunned by that. I think you've got these folks that have this ability, and they transcend the industry in a lot of cases. Don Imus, for lack of a better guy, you know, we've had enough DJs here in LA. Yeah. So, you know, big names, right? Who have been bigger than the station and bigger than the...
yeah.
And not even bigger, but just, they were just great communicators. And that's what it really is all about, is communicating, right? Rick Dees is who I was thinking of.
Rick Dees
was born to be this top 40 guy. Casey Kasem, born to be the top 40 guys, right? Yeah. They could never do what Howard did. They could never do what Don Bowles could do, right? They were just not... But they were good at what they did. Whether you liked him or not.
The other thing that really surprised me about the show, the movie, is that in this movie, this is now 27 years old, he has his select group of people who've now been with him when the movie's made. They've been with him about 15 years. And now, cut away 27 years, those people are all still there.
A few of them, not all.
So
why you don't get off the gravy train, Mike.
So while he seems like he's a little bit of an insane individual, he must be doing something right that these people have hung with him and not gone and said, you know, I can take my talents and I can go work with some other guy. Instead, they're all still with him.
Right.
They've got great chemistry. I mean, they've got really good chemistry, especially him and Robin.
Yeah.
And you can see it in the movie. I'm sorry. So what was that?
He seems like he would be fun to work with.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know... Stern Industries, quote unquote, is a big, big deal right now. It's not like it was 20, 30 years ago. Now it's a production company and they're like a major part of Sirius. And I think with the last contract was $500 million or something like that, which is covering a lot of salaries. So it's not some little thing anymore.
He personally is worth like $700 million or something like that.
Really? I mean,
he's come a long way.
Yeah, I'd say so.
This is not working in Detroit, you know, after hours, you know, at 3 a.m.
It's not a WOLG, no.
No, no, no. Or Cape, what was that? What's the Philly station that he was at?
Oh, WYSP?
YSP, yeah. So,
which is funny because they went all sports now. So,
isn't that funny how the Fanatic stations change?
Or is it 97.5 is the Fanatic? Which one is it?
97.5 is the Fanatic, but they changed their call numbers to WFAN.
Oh, okay.
Oh, they're part of the fan.
Excuse me. They may have been something else before.
Yeah, he's way larger, but the community is still big, right? I mean, even though he's changed his act, he's not the raunchy guy as much as he once was, his act has become more, for lack of a better term, mature. You know, the guests that he gets now are like on a certain very high level. I mean, he had the president on last week.
Yeah.
I mean, that you'd have never had Hillary Clinton on.
Joe Biden.
Yeah, Biden was on last week on a Sunday, on a Sunday, I think it was.
Wow. Okay.
He had Hillary Clinton on. He's had, you know, people that would not have been 30 years ago, he would have had porn stars on, right? And now it's big politicians and Springsteen and you know, Billy Joel and whoever else. He's in a different class of entertainment, I think, than he once was. But I think he was always a rebel. I think that's, even though he's a big dollar rebel, he's still railed against the big corporate-y guys in the beginning, kind of making you listen to the same 30 songs every or 20 songs every hour. He was never into that. He didn't like that. He wanted to be more, I think, which I respect a lot.
I mean, I love it when somebody is a rebel and they stay true to who they are and people love them for it. And then they get rich off of being who they are authentically. That's amazing.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And there are people that are very critical of that. Oh, you sold out, you know, whoever you sold, whether it's Springsteen or whether it's Stern. Hey, it's okay to make money. It's okay to make money the way you want to make money. It's fine. Don't, you can't be that same person that was interviewing porn stars forever.
And I think he benefited a little bit to some of the FCC restrictions that got eased, where you were able to buy more stations in different markets and then you could be syndicated.
Correct.
Where I think syndication just was huge. That almost was a death knell to the local disc jockey in some areas, where we're just going to pipe in the guy from the bigger market and they're going to play the same 20 songs or we're going to get two shock jocks or a morning zoo or something else come in.
And this is
because it was easier.
Dovetail.
Very, very much of a dovetail here with the FCC because Stern was fined, or his stations were fined $2.5 million by the FCC. Still, I think the largest, I think, fines leveled on radio.
Wow,
radio stations. And Sue had her little battle with the FCC as well.
Wow, I was actually going to ask what is actually the fine for having a pirate radio station? I mean, is there jail time, or is it just they shut you down and you pay a fine?
It's mostly fines. I was never fined. Stephen Dunifer, who started this whole thing, he was fined $20,000 and didn't pay it. The lawyer who sort of developed the whole legal argument that allowed all of us micro radio operators to proliferate, he said that the FCC didn't really like fining the operators back at that time because if they were challenged, they didn't want to have to address the legal issues about access to the airwaves. So they didn't really fine a lot of people. They fined Dunifer. They find a guy who is sort of the precursor to Dunifer, but I didn't really hear of anybody else being fined, including myself.
So what do you know what the law is today? I mean, you'd still have to, you could not do this today, right?
I think the fines right now are very substantial. So we're talking $20,000 30 years ago. I think the fines, because there was a law passed in Congress in the early 2000s, where I feel like the fines went up significantly to maybe like $1 million a day.
Yeah, whoa. So
that's part of the reason why you really don't. First of all, it's not necessary like it seemed to be at the time.
Now you just start a podcast.
Yeah
exactly.
Stream anywhere.
Access.
Yeah.
But I do know that there are some people who still do it. I don't know if they're aware that like the fines are really, really hefty. It's probably the exact same situation where it's like a slap of the wrist at first, like just go off the air and we're good. You know, who knows? My guess is it's happened.
And is the equipment a little better than your Radio Shack components?
What?
Is the equipment now a little bit better than your Radio Shack components? So when the FCC seizes the gear, it's maybe a little more substantial too.
It probably is better, but I have not been in that world for a very long time. Stephen Dunifer is still making kits, by the way.
I would think in rural America, that is still a thing, right? I would think if you're the preppers and lots of folks that are off the grid are probably broadcasting out of some little cabin somewhere.
It's funny that you say that, because I kind of want to have a little station in a suitcase to be able to broadcast. Yeah. I feel like it is actually going to be very helpful at some point if, you know, society crumbles, as many people predict.
Sure. When the zombie apocalypse is here, then they don't have radio stations. Yeah.
When the apes rise up and become our overlords, that one.
Yeah. Right. That's
right. And I know that Jennifer has actually gone to like third world countries and set up stations for people in, you know, Haiti. And because one of the things in countries in turmoil is one of the first things they do is like take out the systems of communication with people. Yep. And so they will actually mow down like an entire radio station. So he's helped places. I think Haiti is where he told me he had done this, like building a radio station to operate out of something that doesn't look like a radio station.
Sure.
They don't even know where it is. It's like incognito. So you can still communicate to people. And I feel like I totally believe that it's a good thing to have.
Oh, totally. Because there's, in those instances, they're cutting off internet access. So you even can't get news. So if you have that guerrilla mentality to still communicate to your whoever for freedom, I'm all for it. And it is a weird thing that we have, that the FCC, the attitude they had from the beginning about public safety and infringing on other radio stations, all that was just, to me, has always been nonsense. And people should be allowed to do this. What you did should be allowed to be done. It shouldn't be a pirated thing. Maybe there should be some cost to it, but they're public airwaves.
Yeah, we did give birth to a whole class of license called low power FM. Right. Unfortunately, they're not really available in big urban markets like this.
Right.
But it does exist, you know,
you could
do it, but they also have very limited windows of opportunity to apply. It's not a perfect system, but it's there, you know?
Yeah. And that's the freedom of access. That's not really that free. If the access is limited, it's not very free, is it?
Is one of the big fears that your signal would overlap with a signal that was licensed and paid for in a commercial business? Is that really the big problem? Like, you would infringe not on the public, but on a corporation?
That was a huge issue. Yeah.
From the corporation's attitude, is that for sure?
Yeah. And it really depends on where you decide to set up. I mean, there was one frequency in Los Angeles where you were clear. You know, if you click across the dial, like we were at 104.7, it was clear at 104.5 and 104.9. That was the only place where you wouldn't really be interfering with other signals. Like the closest station that was operating on our same frequency was in Oxnard, which is, I think, like 60 or 80 miles from here. So there was no way that we were interfering with them. But the other argument that they raised back in the day was that our signals were not, you know, they were like loose. They were interfering with like air traffic control, you know, that we could be bringing planes down.
How's your interfere and someone else doesn't? I mean, isn't it all?
So your pirate radio was a terrorist organization?
I don't really understand tactically that argument, you know. Yeah. Radio on some level is still very much a mystery to me.
So now it would be what, like you're interfering with pacemakers and people's, you know, diabetes.
Garage doors. Garage door openers. Your remote on your TV. Yeah. It was silly then and it's silly now. And it was always bankrolled by big radio.
Growing up, my dad had an old radio that he would let us play with every once in a while. And you could get baseball games. I grew up in Northeast Philadelphia. You could get baseball games as far as Detroit with the signal coming in on certain days when certain
weather. Shortwave radio?
Just a regular radio, but it picked up these signals from great distances. And, you know, you flip through the dial. It was just, you know, AM stations that you're trying to pick up ball games. But we actually got home games for the Detroit Tigers. I think they may have been broadcasting at a signal strength that they were not supposed to be. So I find it amusing that you would be cracked down on, but they would not be.
Well, FM doesn't go as far as AM. AM can right. go.
Yeah, but even still, they like they yeah. were well into other people's markets. Somebody should have been saying something about
them. Yeah. My parents had a house.
Seem to care.
My parents had a house in Palm Desert back in the 70s. And so we're out in the desert, and I'd go out there, and you have a regular stereo, and you could get Texas stations, Arizona stations. It was because it was clear. There was no yeah. impediments, right? And you could get, I don't know, Salt Lake City. It was just all over. It was amazing. It was great. And then, in fact, that's actually where the first time I heard Howard Stern, because there was a station I could hear in San Diego in the desert, and they would take Stern shows and replay them on the weekends at night before, you know, it was before he was syndicated. Right. And who is this guy? And then the next thing I know, he's showing up on Letterman. Who is this guy? And then, you know, then he starts becoming syndicated and we get him out here. And when I go back east, I heard about him and I drive around for, you know, on a visit to somebody. And, oh my God, this is a real thing. Wow. He's just not just a guy on Letterman. Radio is just amazing. It's still romantic to me. It's still a cool medium. And as much as I don't listen to it anymore, except for a couple like sports stations here and news stations and FM a little bit, it's still a really cool medium. And I hope it never goes away. I always worry that it might, because it's now with the internet, you know, it's just it actual radio is not much of a thing as much as it once was.
I don't think it's ever going to go away. I mean, I want people to migrate to the internet. That just means that maybe it'll free up the airwaves.
Yeah. That's true. That's true.
Yeah.
They won't be looking anymore.
No. Well, and it's a weird business too, because I think there's been such a migration away from traditional radio, terrestrial radio, and now you can get your radio in a lot of different places and music. So there are less stations. Some of the big boys are not, they don't have the number of stations that they used to. They lose a lot of money. Clear Channel loses a lot of money. Our Heart loses a lot of money. They're just not the big cash cows that they once were, because there's so much other competition with satellite and everything else. Mm-hmm. But I hope it never goes away. It's fun to drive. I'm looking forward to making this road, going on this road trip with my daughter in a week, just to hear radio out in the middle of nowhere.
So no Sirius on this road trip?
There's no, we didn't pay for the Sirius in my daughter's car. No. So it's a regular radio.
There you go. All right, good.
Although I could stream it from my phone, but we'll see.
Yeah. I love it. Especially when you get to a place like Nebraska and then you hear the advertising, like,
for it's the best.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just like a bygone era, you know?
You know, what's also interesting about radio is still in America especially on AM, I guess even in Los Angeles in big markets, is how much foreign language stations there are, how many there are. I mean, there's all this, we have this amazing cross-cultural, multicultural country, and they're communicating and hearing their communities on radio still too. So maybe that's really the where radio still thrives, is on those kinds of...
The lower end of the dial... some foreign language and all the colleges.
Yeah.
And the top end of the dial is the rest of the foreign languages. And then everything in between is the sweet spot, you know.
Yes. You know, everything on the middle is the big companies.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, from the user perspective, it's still free. So you don't need an internet connection. You don't need any of that stuff.
You just need a radio.
From the producer perspective, it's a different story, because they got to buy the equipment. They got to buy the channel. They got to get their license, all that kind of stuff. And hopefully they get enough advertising to, you know, keep them afloat.
That's so always been about,
keeping radios in cars.
What was that?
Well, that
how do you feel about keeping radios in cars. That big debate happening right now. Should the automakers have to put radios in cars? They don't want to, you know.
There's a fight. There's a bit of a fight for it. I think Tesla wanted it. They got rid of them, right? And who is it? I think it was a Ford saying they were going to get rid of it, but then Congress said, no, you can't do that, or we don't want you to. I think it was Ford or GM. Personally, I think they should have radios in cars. I'm old school. I want a radio in my car with a button that I push on. I want five presets.
Well, you still have five presets. It's just not like the old,
Like not clicky ones. I want clicky ones.
I'll go as far as six presets. Any more than that, it's just too much.
It really is too much. Five is plenty. I can name them right now, the ones I want on AM.
Five presets, five fingers. It all makes sense. I got
That's totally it. Yeah. With a dial for the rate, for the volume. Of, you know. Yeah.
You don't do the scan. Just click. Good song.
It's the worst. Song it is the worst.
And I get the last minute and a half of a 4 minute song. Yeah, that's great. And then we scan to the next one. Oh, yes. That's my kids.
Now, all that said, I'm on Sirius a lot. You really have not the whole world in your hands, but you have a lot of the world in your hands. Like TV, you have it right there with you all over. I was listening. The guys are in New Jersey, Philadelphia area, Sue. And last Friday, I was driving out to a show in Long Beach, and Andrew's watching the 76ers game. I was listening to the 76ers game from the 76ers broadcast in my car.
Yeah, Tom McGinnis in LA.
It's great. I'm a Steeler fan, and I listen to Steeler games with a Steeler broadcast. It's
that's cool.
It's amazing. I'm 3,000 miles away, and I can hear that. You can't do that with AM and FM radio. That's true.
We're stealing some pirate signals. You could, but otherwise.
Oh, really? That would be very difficult.
Unless they syndicated the broadcast.
If they syndicate, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. And Mike, any thoughts on the Stern movie? Last thoughts?
I was a little surprised he didn't follow it up with another movie.
Well, that's always been a thought because it comes to a point in his career.
It just surprised me that he didn't come back with another movie or become an actor that was in other movies.
Well, you know, it certainly didn't stop him from making $700 million.
No. Obviously, he had other things to do, but I'm just surprised he didn't act in something else.
He's been offered various roles and turned them down. He got into doing the one of those competition shows for a while. One of those singing shows.
I thought
things,
he was pretty good, actually. He was a pretty good actor.
No, because he never act.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he was pretty good. You know, you'd think he would be kind of cheesy or like, let's say, like Seinfeld, who was really not that great on the show. He was funny.
As an actor,
not really.
Yeah.
Howard was a much better actor.
And from my understanding, reading the Unfrosted reviews, he's not
much of a director.
No, I saw it, and he's not great, but it's funny. It's cute.
It's still funny, but he's not.
No, he's a stand-up comedian.
Yeah.
I think an interesting to look at his career post where the movie ends would be interesting, where he really fights against the FCC and fights terrestrial radio and being kind of harnessed more than he wants to be harnessed, and then making a pretty critical jump, career change, if you think about it, to this fledgling industry who you don't know if this satellite thing is ever going to work. There were none of these things in cars at the time, hardly. And who's going to listen? Who's going to go buy one of these weird radios, just listen to something called satellite radio? And now, you know, it paid off. It's a big company. It's been there for almost 20 years.
His jump was what, XM?
It was XM Sirius.
But he was XM.
They merged.
And then they almost bought him. And Sirius bought him out, right?
Correct.
And they gave him stock and all sorts of other crazy things. I mean, it was an incredible deal.
I believe my wife worked on one of those satellites, I think, back then. I believe. Way back in her early satellite.
That's one of the satellites you can talk about?
That's one that she can talk about. Yeah, I remember the satellites were called. There was two because you had to cover the whole country. And one satellite was called Rock, and the other one was called Roll. Rock and Roll.
So if she could give us access to those satellites, we could have a super pirate radio station right now.
Yeah, that would be a really good one. You could get pretty good,
coverage
on the moon. Yes. So I
need a big antenna on my roof. I could do something else with it. Is that what you're telling me?
Remember the whole dish thing? And oh my God, that's crazy. I'm thinking about the early ones that I had in my car, and they had these weird little, oh my God, you had to like plaster these little satellite antennas on your car, and the glue would stick forever. And oh my God, it's amazing now that it's all like incorporated into the window of your car. Now you don't even have to get some funky little, and there's wires going all over inside of your car. Oh my God. These are a lot of bad memories. and remember a radio in your car? It was just a stick on the outside of the car.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That was it.
It would break when
it was simple.
The car wash if you didn't.
It would break when you went to the car wash, but you could replace it. You went to Pep Boys and get a new one.
That's true.
That was easy. complicated now. I like the movie. I thought it was really good. I think on a rewatch it might be even better now. Like you said,
it's fun. It was fun. I liked it. You know, it was nice. I loved
Paul Giamatti.
Paul Giamatti was great. You know, it was nice too. Like, just you saw the chemistry with Robert and Howard in the few scenes where they had together, where they were just talking.
Yeah,
and you could see that. You know, they like each other. You know what I mean? They like each other. They're like working with each other.
Yeah.
So they're clearly friends.
And Fred and Gary too. I think.
Yeah, they were great. You could just tell they were having a good time.
And it is weird to think that they are 70-ish.
Yep.
70-ish. Granted, we'll be there
We're not far off there.
We're not far off.
Some days, I think I might be 70-ish.
Yeah, I know the feeling. Yes.
Well, like we said before, like, why wouldn't you want to work with your friends, right? We talked about like the movie business where all these guys make movies together.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you want to make movies with your friends?
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
But that's what you did, Sue. I mean, that's...
Work with your friends.
Get all your friends.
That's what we're doing here. That's what this is all about.
Yeah. Now, back to Sufra a bit here. You mentioned it a bit. I wanted to bring it up. So this book, this story.
When did the book come out, Sue?
20 years ago.
Yeah.
20 years ago. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And, I mean, I'm really happy that I wrote it at the time.
So if you have a big surge on Amazon.
Yes.
Well, it had very little to do with us.
So sure. I think it's really funny that there has been this really interesting surge. Have you seen a surge? Do you get any residuals anymore from book sales?
No, it's out of print. So no.
It's out of print.
It's out of print.
So it's all used. I think mine might have been used when I got it. I can't remember.
And now you're doing a documentary basically on the book or, you know, what happened.
I think, Aaron, the whole reason we're even in touch is because you saw the play, right?
I was part of the immersive experience, yes.
Yeah, so the weird thing about this book is that, you know, I wrote it because I wanted to write it while the memories were still fresh. And thank God I did, because I recently reread it and I was like, I don't remember any of this.
And you wrote it.
And I wrote it. You know,
that's most of my day.
time for an epilogue.
But weirdly, you know, this couple, Mr. and Mischief, who do these immersive experiences, they found the book, just discovered it like 4 years ago, which has breathed new life into this whole thing. So they made this experience. Aaron, you went to go see it. I helped them recreate this space in Silver Lake that was very much like the station that actually existed in Silver Lake. So I decided to bring back a bunch of the DJs for a weekend. Through that process of doing a live stream with a lot of the original DJs, I found out
that was fun.
Yeah, I thought so too. I thought they did an amazing.
It was really fun. Yeah.
That all this vintage footage existed. And I didn't remember that any of that had been shot. So there were 12 hours of footage. And I feel like since I learned that that existed and the DJ who shot it was saying I could do whatever I wanted with it and I'm a journalist, it just seemed like, why wouldn't I try to make a documentary? So the rough cut is done and we're going to start doing our first like feedback screenings in a couple weeks.
I'm excited about this. This is so great. I should say, so this couple, I saw this story somewhere too, where they found the book, they found the story, and then they put on these immersive experiences, various kinds. And they're all kind of fun, right? You don't know. It's almost like an escape room. You know, you just know where this is going to go. And a friend of mine, who is a cocktail person also here in Los Angeles, Jen Wong. I don't know if you remember Jen. Yeah, yes. I know you know Jen.
Yes, I love Jen.
The Way of the Wong. She's a voice actress, does a lot of stuff. So she had put on Instagram that she was doing this thing. I think, wasn't it in La Jolla first?
It was, right? It debuted in La Jolla and then they brought it back in Silver Lake. Yeah.
And so I told my wife about this and she said, oh, we got to do this. And we had no idea what this was. So crazy what this was, and we were
seeing the screen. That's very funny.
Yeah. That's my problem. I'm a name dropper. I barely know Angela, I know
everybody else,
and he's right, he's like 75 feet from my house. So
there you go. This was the weirdest experience I've ever had, and it was the most fun. And my wife and I were told to go to this place on Sunset in Silver Lake and stand in front of this building. And we were met by this two people, I think it was Andy and I can't remember his name. Jeff.
Was there a and white they, van?
There was. There might have been a white van. There could have been a white van. And and we were both thrown into it. No.
There was a white windowless van. I had a briefcase full of money.
And we were given these little kind of weird instructions about we're going to be meeting someone with a red backpack somewhere on Sunset. And they and we turned around and then these two people were gone. And then we see a person at this bar down the street sitting with a red backpack. And that was the big, and we had to go talk to this person who started this experience for us. And we were taken to this apartment, which wasn't very far away, a second floor apartment, a first floor apartment, I guess. And it was like walking into Sue's life, or actually Paige Jarrett's life. And we had headsets on and we were told to do all these things as if we were Paige Jarrett. And we were playing records and we were trying to pay the bills and keep the cops away. And God, what else was in there?
Any guns?
There was no guns. We had to play records and we had to like
sabers.
Do
sabers. There were
sabers and no neighbors. It was wild. It was so fun. And I walked away missing because thinking I wanted to be in the radio business when back in my youth too. And this was as close as I ever got. This was so great. It was so fun. Yeah. Because I went to radio school for like 20 minutes and
oh wow.
Long, long ago, yeah. But that was just so fun. And now that it's coming almost full circle where you're putting this documentary together, this is just so great. 20 years after the fact, right? 20 years after the book and what, 20, 30 years almost since you were doing this for real.
Yeah. It's amazing. The goal is to get it into South by Southwest Film Festival for 2025. That would be the third awesome. Year anniversary of when I actually started it.
Oh, man, that's just great. Yeah, fingers crossed. Any last thoughts, boys and girls, on the movie, on pirate radio, on being a rebel? Yeah, we had lots of movies we could have chosen, by the way. We could have chosen Pump Up the Volume. That's a pirate radio, too, show, movie.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But Stern was good. He was rebel in his own right.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was good fun. It was fun to revisit the movie. It was on like HBO all the time. And then of course, when I want to watch it, then when I want to watch it, I got to go rent it. It's like, come on.
Me too.
72 streaming channels and it's not streaming anywhere.
I can't believe I didn't have it on DVD. I looked everywhere. I thought I bought that thing 20 years ago and I didn't.
Did you say it was on Hulu, Mike?
Hulu.
What?
I found it on Hulu.
I bought it for $3.99 on Apple.
Yeah, so did I.
Damn it.
Oh, well.
Jeez. I'm going to take your tip. I'm going to watch it on Hulu.
There you go.
Yes.
Yeah. There you go.
Good. Yeah, it's good. And you got to keep watching through the credits a little bit too. It's fun. Okay. Sue, we can't thank you enough for coming on. I'm glad we reconnected. I'm really happy. Hey,
so if you get when the documentary is done and you're ready to premiere, you come back and talk about the documentary.
Come back. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you turn us on to a
come back whenever, but you know.
You turn us on to Minx.
Minx.
We're going to go look up for Minx. Yeah. Minx. That's a funny name.
Oh, go back to motorcycles. So do you ride motorcycles currently?
I don't currently, but I used to.
Now, were you like cruisers, sport bikes? What's your like?
I liked a naked bike.
Okay. All right.
But I was the motorcycle critic at the LA Times. So I wrote everything, you know, for a minute.
Oh, that's awesome.
Years.
I'm jealous.
But dirt bikes and naked bikes, those were my things.
Okay. So favorite bike? Like of all the ones you've ever tested, did you have a favorite? Like a Triumph, a Ducati? I always wanted a motorcycle. I had a motorcycle license, but I never actually owned one.
So. Yeah. I'm a big Ducati fan. I feel like Ducati can't do wrong. Yeah.
Okay. And they're dangerous and they're beautiful and all kinds of good stuff.
Yeah, both of those things. Yeah.
BMWs. I always like the BMWs too.
Oh, those are gorgeous.
The older ones, though, the R's with the horizontally opposed twins. They were always nice.
Yes. So
I don't know if you know this, but they've come up with this thing now. Instead of two wheels, it has four. And
all right. Doors, this is where I mute Mike. This is where
I mute windscreen. It's
so nice. Mike is in insurance.
With radio. With radio.
It's all about liability. So, you know.
And if you ask, you get a radio, which is nice.
You can get a radio on a motorcycle. Bluetooth has come a long way.
Really?
Oh.
Huh. Two wheels.
Actually, I've actually dictated text messages while riding.
Oh my gosh.
Because they have Apple CarPlay on the Honda Gold.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
As a really little kid, one of my mother's cousins married this super hippie, super cool guy, and he had a motorcycle. And I was not allowed to ride on the back of the motorcycle because I was too small. Ever since really? That day, motorcycles are terrible. I don't like motorcycles. They're not nice. I did not get to ride on it.
Oh, that's so funny.
I don't want to hear about motorcycles ever.
I've only ridden, I have family in Europe. I have family in Italy. So I have families in Sicily. I have family in Milan. So my cousin in Milan, the dentist, he would take his BMW to the office. And he was an absolute maniac. I mean, you know how they have like the trolleys and all that stuff? He's just, whatever, I'm doing whatever I want. You know,
that sounds dangerous.
White lining is not a thing in Italy. You do whatever you want. Go. Mm-hmm. Like, why am I sitting behind a car? I'm on a motorcycle. That's why I'm on a motorcycle, so I can get around you. So, which I think makes sense, you know, as long as you do it responsibly. So, but anyway, fun.
Yeah.
So behind me, you see where my pen is pointing here, is on my one of my heroes, Neil Peart from Rush, drummer.
Oh, uh-huh. Big time motorcycle guy.
Big time motorcycle guy. And if you are interested in reading travel books, he wrote before his death, he wrote 4 or 5 about his travels across America and into South America on bike, and also bicycling in West Africa. And they're like travel books, but really fascinating about, you know, and
yeah, I would love to read them.
Really good. And they're actually on Audible too. He doesn't read them, but they're really good. And really seeing it. Seeing the back roads of America between, he'd do this on between tour. So the rest of the band would travel by tour bus or airplane. He would ride between Wichita and Dallas or something. And, but never on the interstates, right? It was always on the back roads. So really, really interesting stuff.
Great. Thanks for that tip.
Yes. So again, we had Sue Carpenter on What We Watch When We Drink. 40 watts to nowhere, from nowhere. Available like at maybe Abe Books, one of the good used booksellers. You can still find this thing. That's in fact where I got it, was Abe Books, I think. Really fun story. Really fun talking to you. This is great. It's a really great story about ingenuity and energy in America and radio on a micro level, which is, that's so awesome. It's so cool. So
pleasure to meet all of you. It was fun.
Sue, yes, it was. Fun. Thank you for coming.
Yes, yes. And cheers to all. Happy Whiskey Wednesday. Cheers, cheers. Clink, clink. Cheers. All right.
Sue, don't leave. We're going to run the
Good luck with the documentary.
Oh, thank you.
Yes. Keep us posted.
I will.
All right. Close it. Get us out of here.
All right. So we'll have this out as a podcast soon.
Soon.
Within the week. I can probably do this within the week. Unedited, uncut, a whole bit. It'll be good.
Boom.
So, all right. Thank you. And cheers, folks.
If you enjoy this show, please subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, Google, Audible, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. You can also find us on boozedancing.com. And if you have any questions, comments, show, or drink suggestions, email us at boozedancing@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.